We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Alex, and today we're speaking with special guest Robert Kaplan, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Prior to his appointment, Mr. Kaplan served as the Vice Chairman of the Goldman Sachs Group, leading their investment banking and investment management divisions. After his 23-year career at the firm, Mr. Kaplan returned to HBS in 2006 and became the Martin Marshall Professor of Management Practice and a Senior Associate Dean. Mr. Kaplan also serves as a co-chair of the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation, a global venture philanthropy firm supporting early-stage, high-impact social enterprises. The foundation aims to fund innovative young leaders and help develop their startups by providing experienced partners and unrestricted capital. They have successfully supported over 180 organizations since 2002 and are currently deploying their fourth fund of $80 million to sponsor the next generation of social entrepreneurs. Mr. Kaplan was also a trustee of the Ford Foundation, is an acclaimed author, and co-chairs Project ALS, alongside his day-to-day responsibilities managing the 11th Federal Reserve District. Now let's get to the bottom line. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Mr. Kaplan. I know you're busy as a bee, and this pandemic certainly can't be helping your workload, so let's just dive right in. Can you share your path with our audience? What passion has really driven you from, you know, college all the way through HBS, Goldman Sachs, and now the Federal Reserve?
Initially, and this is back to when I was in college and beyond, I had a passion for the markets. So my father and my mom taught me about the stock market when I was probably after my bar mitzvah, when I first had like $400 or $500. And they took me early on to buy a stock. I think it was Russell Stover Candy. And a long time ago. And the long and the short of it is I had a passion for the markets. And so I graduated Kansas. I was a certified public accountant, believe it or not, well kept secret. But I realized that maybe I'd like to do something else. And I wound up applying to business school, and I went to Harvard Business School. But always in the back of my mind and always in the forefront was passion for the markets. So I did McKinsey for the summer and Trammell Crow. I split the summer, first and second year. And then when I graduated, I went to Goldman Sachs. I really did not want to go to New York City. I grew up in Kansas. New York City scared me. But I got over it, and that's what drove me why I went to Goldman Sachs. And listen, I found out over 23 years or so that, you know, investment bank was a great place if you love the markets. It's a supermarket of all kinds of markets and clients, and so I never unendingly interesting for me. And then at the firm, I developed a parallel interest, which is in leading, managing, and ultimately, as later in my career, all the running the partnership committee, all the training, the new Pine Street leadership program training, a lot of the people issues and leadership issues. I became a little bit more the go-to person at the firm for those, as well as running investment banking and investment management. And I'll say two more chapters, I guess. After having been at the firm for a long time, I felt that I wanted to do other things in my life. And that's what caused me to become an instructor at Harvard Business School. I chose leadership to teach. I didn't think I'd be there that long, but I wound up staying for 10 years and became ultimately a professor of management practice and senior associate dean. And then that was a great experience because I really learned a lot about leadership, organization, behavior, and I have a passion for that. It's great to be a case method professor, fantastic. And I worked lots with businesses. And then I had the opportunity to do public service, which I always wanted to do. I didn't know what it would be, but I a little awkward to move to Texas from the East Coast, but I took the leap wanting to do public service. And I thought the Fed was a great place, a leadership role at the Fed was a great place to do public service.
Awesome. Well, you certainly have an incredible journey there that, you know, many students can learn from. And, you know, personally, I'm a little bit biased towards Dallas being a great place to live. So I'm going to pass it off to Virginia now to ask you a couple questions about the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
So what spurred you to help lead the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation, and why is high impact social entrepreneurship so important to you?
So in all my years at Goldman Sachs, I was very active involved in the community and in nonprofit work. Probably joined my first nonprofit board when I was in my early 30s. And I got more and more involved in nonprofit leadership. And then I helped at the early stages, I helped to found the TEEK, something called the TEEK Fellowship in New York City. And then I was at the early stages of the development of something called Project ALS, which I'm still co-chairman of. And what I learned from that, I learned I had a passion for early stage nonprofits, not big institutional nonprofits. Even though I was on the board of the Ford Foundation, etc., I found that I could add more value to early stage. So when I got to Harvard as a professor, I wanted to start a firm that incubated early stage nonprofits. While I was busy trying to figure out how to do that, I was introduced to Bill Draper and Robin Richards. This is back in probably 08, as I recall. And it so happens that we hit it off. Bill at that time was in his late 80s Robin and he had been business partners. And they kind of were looking for maybe a partner to take go to the next level. They had done a number of great early stage nonprofits, but in relatively small operation, maybe a $5 million venture fund to do it that was nonprofit. So I joined them, it became Draper Richards Kaplan, and we never looked back, and we built the organization where now we're just on a Zoom call yesterday, we might have 60 employees, 10 managing directors. We're working on a $75 million fund as our current fund, we're about to do another. But the point is we incubate early stage nonprofits. We do about 25 a year. It fits perfectly with what I taught at Harvard Business School and the books I've written on leadership, because I think nonprofit leadership is all the basics of leadership that I taught and wrote about are central to how do you build an early stage nonprofit. Can you build a team? Do you have a clear vision? How do you build a board? A whole range of issues. So it was a natural fit. And yeah, I'm still a big believer that a lot of the big problems of the world are going to be addressed, not necessarily in the for-profit world, and unfortunately not by the government, but they're going to be addressed by these early stage disruptive nonprofits that have a new way of dealing with either an education issue or a crop yield issue in Uganda or empowering women or a whole range of other issues. And the more we do it, the more I'm reinforced and believe that.
Well, 2008 is certainly a significant time period to focus on nonprofit organizations. And you mentioned a little bit about your fund. So with DRK having recently developed its fourth fund of $80 million to support impact and social investing, what does your role look like in terms of identifying these ESG investment opportunities?
So what DRK does is we probably get over 1,000 applications a year. We probably will do detailed due diligence on maybe 40 of them, rough numbers, and we'll pick 20 to 25. And so we've got a little bit the pick of the litter in that we're looking for a great leader or great leaders, impact. So we have to be excited about the impact that nonprofit's going to make. And then the third issue is the model. Does it have a model that's at least been tested? We're early stage, but if the model has never been tried, we'd rather you tried it, even in small form, to see evidence that it worked. And we'd love to see evidence that it can scale. Although for me, scale is not the be all end all, but want it. And a lot of our advice is about the model. And what do I mean by model? Little Kids Rock is an example, I probably never heard of it, of a nonprofit where they originally started out teaching kids how to play an instrument. They realized that the model needed to change, and they're far better off training teachers and teaching them how to train kids how to play an instrument. Subtle change, but pretty significant. And they reach literally, you know, thousands and thousands of kids a year. And their mission is to train teachers, not to train the kids directly. That's an example of a model change. And we're always wrestling with these and advising on what's the right model to deliver this service or other product that delivers impact. And so that's what we're doing. And we're, the more you do that, like anything else, the better you get at. So pattern recognition, the more we see, and we've done now over, I think we're up to, I forget the number, 150, 175 new ventures. You learn, you make your mistakes, and you get better.
Well, obviously you just mentioned a specific startup, but we wanted to ask you, what startup or other ventures have been your favorites, you know, between your experience at your nonprofit organization and the VC fund and also at Harvard Business School? Is there a specific one that stands out to you the most?
Well, I always say at Draper Richards Kaplan, I'm not allowed to have a favorite, and that everything we do is a favorite. But you know, if I'm sitting talking to somebody who lives in a certain city, I'll mention three or four in their city, whether it's in New York City, Green City Force, that help kids after high school, mainly at-risk kids, to help them learn how to green buildings, or urban teacher centers in New York City, and kind of going across the country. But I would say my favorites are always the things that we're doing now. And I'm also amazed at, once you think you figured out the world and what are innovative ways to do things, you know, every year we learn about new things that when you hear the idea, you go, oh, that does make sense. Crisis Hotline is an example. When they first came to us, they do remote, not live phone call, but through text, provide crisis help. And my first reaction is, but it's amazing how effective some of these models have been, even though your first reaction is, I never thought of that, and does that really work? And then you learn more about it, and you realize it could have a big impact. So every time you learn something new like that, that's fun. So that's my favorite, but I'll avoid picking one.
Sure. Well, great insights on the VC world here. We obviously want to jump into the economy. So Alex, why don't you jump into that?
So yeah, I'm going to pivot a little bit to asking you about how, you know, what does your day look like as the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas? How do you interact with banks and other financial institutions to keep the economy running?
So I'd say a third or half of my time is spent either talking to businesses, civic leaders, university presidents, junior college superintendents about skills training, high school superintendents, to try to understand what's going on in the economy. And I'm particularly not only trying to understand businesses, industries, but I'm trying to understand some of the drivers, like early childhood literacy, skills training, and some of the big issues that help improve productivity and where we're struggling. Access to childcare, I spent a lot of time on. So that's literally half my time. And then trying to think about I have over 30 PhD economists here. And I've talked to a range of economists outside the Fed and business leaders to try to understand how the world works, how the machine works, as others would say, and what drives the economy. So that's a good chunk. I spent a quarter of my time, which was what I was just doing before I came down here, managing our 1300 people at the Dallas Fed. And also I chair a committee that oversees technology for the whole system. I just got off chairing a budget committee for the entire system. And so I'm spending a lot of time also system-wide to make sure the management and how we work better. And then the third thing I do is out in the community. I'm out in the community almost every day of the week in some way, shape, or form. Again, getting at these tough issues, lack of Wi-Fi, lack of childcare, early childhood literacy, half-day pre-K versus full-day, and trying to, we can play a big role as a convener in our communities. So those are the three biggest allocations of my time.
Interesting. And I won't address some of those specifics now because Charlotte's going to do that in a minute. But going back to the Great Recession in 2008, if you look at some of the companies that received a large portion of their VC funding during and shortly after the crisis, several successful giants like Facebook, LinkedIn, and Dropbox come to mind. And recently, a majority of these exciting startups in the 21st century have been tech and web focused. So where do you see this trend going in the next decade or so? What do you think the next phase of this evolution is? Blockchain, healthcare, another surge of cloud and web services? What's next?
So what I see is it's hard to think of an industry where either technology is not increasingly replacing people or technology-enabled platforms are not disrupting incumbents. Now, they may not even be technology businesses, but they're a technology-enabled. What's an example? You go to your fast food restaurant and you pre-order. That's technology-enabled, okay? But that is disrupting incumbents who are not technology-enabled. And the impact that all these are having is, I would argue, creating more affordable goods and services, greater convenience, and probably limiting the pricing power of business, okay? But it's also having a profound impact on the workforce and the training needs of the workforce, which I can talk more about. But what do I think? I think the trend of technology-enabled disruption is accelerating. And a lot of a digital capability might have been nice to have 5 years ago. Today, it's mandatory, and the pandemic has accelerated that. And obviously, there's the gigantic platforms. You referred to some gigantic tech companies. And then there's the startups and the new ones. And I think the impact that those companies are having on the economy is still probably in the early stages, believe it or not, and is going to become far more extensive. There are going to be plenty of jobs, by the way, in my opinion, in the years and decades ahead, but the training needed to do those jobs is going to change. And so the workforce is going to have to be more adaptable, including if you got a college degree, you may have to be prepared. Your business is going to be more likely to get disrupted. Your function may be disrupted, and you're going to have to learn to get retrained and be adaptable. It's easier with a college education, we're finding, than those with a high school education or less.
Interesting. All right. So that phrase, technology-enabled disruption, limiting the pricing power of businesses, just to expand on that a little bit, what you mean by that is whether or not technology, you know, makes labor more productive, it replaces labor, things like that. And you see the trends of, you know, developing those technologies controlling where the market goes in the next.
There's that, but also, and we take it for granted, there's a whole range of things people used to pay for that are now free. Okay, so when I'm talking to a person in the newspaper business and they say, what are you talking about? What am I talking about? What do you charge for your paper? What's happened to your circulation? What's happened to the revenues of your paper? They're declining by and large, not totally, but look what's happened to local newspapers and every single industry. Higher education used to be thought digital, nah, the college experience got to be in person. And we're finding, I don't know, Khan Academy and other HBX, are high enough quality that, you know, all they need to do is just chip away a little bit at traditional enrollment and it changes the business model. That's happening in every single industry. And again, it'd be a way of saying what used to be distinctive, what was distinctive a year or two ago, isn't distinctive anymore, might not be, because of technology-enabled disruption, where people used to pay me to do X, Y, or Z, and now they get it for free, and I've got to do that, and I've got to find a different way to charge, or figure out a product or service that's still distinctive. And so the number one question, and I wrote a book on this pathetically while I was at Harvard, the biggest question business leaders ask, and it's more important today than ever before, what do you do that's distinctive? What product or service do you and value do you add that's actually distinctive? And that question is evolving, and technology enabled disruption means, man, if it was distinctive 3 years ago, may not be distinctive today. And you're going to have to keep refining what you're doing to be distinctive and find ways also to be more efficient, because you're going to have to give more things away for free in order to have the right to sell the thing that you can actually charge for. Also, it's changed by the way the value of data, in that there's a lot of things where, you know, if for those of you on your call, I bet a lot of people are on a platform where they can buy and sell securities. Well, increasingly now, there are no brokerage costs, free. How are they able to do that? Well, because they're selling the data or the order flow. But these are massive changes, and we take them for granted. Some of these things are unthinkable that people could get these things for free. And that's the trend.
Awesome. Well, Charlotte's going to take over our last set of questions here, but thank you so much for addressing that.
Yes, thank you so much for your answer. And there's some really great insights. I just want to pivot back to a little bit of what Alex was mentioning briefly earlier. And my question is, the Federal Reserve has been looking into a central bank digital coin for some time. And how likely do you think that reality is? And do you think that Bitcoin is going to the moon? Or are you more concerned about its speculative nature?
So I differentiate the digital currency from Bitcoin. To this point, Bitcoin and other digital cryptocurrencies have been maybe more thought of as a store of value, not necessarily, I'm not as sure that they're going to become widely traded currencies because they're so darn volatile. So one of the things that a digital currency will have is some stability and value. So if I buy a loaf of bread, you know, the buyer and seller can know what the heck we're getting. I would expect the central bank in the United States and around the central banks around the world will do more work on digital currencies. And there's a lot of reasons why you could think that's the case. But I would differentiate that from cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, which may still have legs and may well have legs as a store of value. I'm less certain about their use as widespread commerce.
Right, that completely makes sense. And being a little bit volatile, that's not something that might happen currently. I want to move a little bit to more asking about your thoughts generally in the economy. And my next question is, how do you think the rising inflation from the stimulus and the quantitative easing that began last March will affect venture capital investments?
The U.S. economy, I don't need to tell people on this call, contracted in the neighborhood of 2.5% last year. We thought it would be much worse earlier in the year. And the reason it wasn't much worse is the substantial amount of fiscal policy, which helped keep household incomes relatively stable levels and consumer spending stayed strong. As we go into 2021, as we continue to vaccinate people, and I'm hopeful the vaccinations will outpace, at least in the United States, will outpace the variants. Outside the US, they're at a different stage, which is we're watching carefully. Our forecast right now at the Dallas Fed is that GDP growth this year will be in the range of 6.5%. The unemployment rate will start grinding down from where it is right now, which is a little bit above 6%. And we think we'll end the year in the neighborhood of 4%. Inflation, you were asked about it. People are assuming that we're going to have much higher inflation. I can tell you what we know and what we don't know. It's clear that year over year price increases during 21 will be significant. One of the reasons for that is they were so weak a year ago that as we get into May and June and July and August, the year over year comparisons will be strong. By the time we get to the end of the year, though, the year over year comparisons may settle down a bit because fourth quarter last year was strong. And so we still think inflation, headline inflation, may run this year at 2-2.25%, but it we'll have to see. And then heading into 2022, most of the businesses I talk to that are raising prices right now that are able to are very skeptical that they're going to be able to raise prices again next year. They don't know, but their jury's out. Why is the jury out? There's clearly going to be a surge in demand. There is a surge in demand. There will be a surge in demand. There's a lot of money out there. There's a high level of savings. On the other hand, technology-enabled disruption is also intensifying. So on this one, I think the jury's out. And so I'd be watching it. We'll be watching it very, very carefully. In terms of how it affects venture capital, I don't know when we look back 5 or 10 years from now, there'll be a lot of factors that affect venture capital. I am not certain yet that inflation will be one of them. I don't know. I do think that the dramatic rise and acceleration of disruption is going to have a big effect on these venture platforms and new ventures. And you're going to see lots of structural changes going on in the U.S. economy. You know, what's an example of a structural change? We're overstored in the United States by multiples per capita versus most other countries. We knew that was going to return, that was going to decline. The pandemic had accelerated it. So commerce is being done in a different way. That's going to create an opportunity for, I would think, lots of new ventures, platforms, et cetera. But I think those structural changes, some easy to predict, some not so easy to predict, are going to be a bigger driver than necessarily inflationary dynamics. But I'd say the jury's out on that.
Right. Thank you so much for your thoughts. We really appreciate hearing your opinions, and it's and how inflation affects venture capital investments. I imagine it's something we're going to have to look forward to in the future. My next question I want to ask more related to startups. So how do you think Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package and the additional $2 trillion spending plan will affect business growth and investment, particularly in startups in the short run? And then in the long run, can we expect to meet projections as in most situations?
So some of the money is going to help speed vaccinations, speed in-person school reopenings, help people who've lost their job who can't get enough or can't get enough hours to make ends meet. And yeah, in some cases, the money's just going to go in people's pockets that make a certain income level. And then the question is how much of that will go into spending on what, goods or services. And so we're going to have lots of demand. How much of that is going to lead to more business investment? I think the question is not what happens in 21 when you make a business investment. It's what to expect growth is going to be in 22, 23, 24. Business investments are long-term investments. And the only comment I would make is, I do think that people may be surprised to hear over the horizon, past 2023, for example, GDP growth is going to trend back down toward 2%. Okay, why is that? Two big reasons. One, workforce growth is slowing because of aging. And yes, we have these new generations coming down the pike to replace the baby boomers, thankfully. But our own estimates of workforce growth are, you know, it's slowing versus past decades. GDP growth is made of growth in the workforce plus growth in productivity. And then the second question is, while there's all this productivity improvements in companies, they tend to be affecting, in my experience, people with a college education or greater more than they do people with a high school education or less. Many work in service sector and person-to-person contact industries. And so unless we see an improvement in either workforce growth and or productivity growth, GDP growth is going to get back down. So that's still, to me, the number one driver and that's why some of these infrastructure, I'll stay away from getting into the whole infrastructure program, but certain key elements of infrastructure, greater access to Wi-Fi, other investments, and things that help improve sustainable longer-term growth, some of these structural reforms, improving early childhood literacy, skills training, that can help improve longer-term growth, I think that'll do more to encourage investment and be more significant, because businesses are thinking of what's growth down the road, not what is it right now or a year from now when you make these investments.
Thank you. That's really interesting, hearing how structural changes will more impact investments. So we want to end off with our last question, and this is something that we ask every person that we interview. And it's essentially to get to the bottom of the bottom line. But we want to ask you, what is your hottest take or most controversial opinion? And this doesn't have to be related to our question or discussion at all. It could be anything you would like to touch on.
Well, I'll give you my best advice. How's that? Because I taught students for a long time and they're given advice a lot. And I see the same mistakes over and over, and I see people do the right things over and over. And here's the number one advice that we give people on this call. Don't worry about what's hot. This is the venture capital club. Maybe that's going to be hot in the future. Maybe it's not. I have no clue. But I think more important to your success is going to be, do you know your strengths and weaknesses, what you're good at and what you're not, is what you need to work on? Do you have people who care enough about you to tell you the truth so you can understand better your strengths and weaknesses? And then the second question is, what do you have a passion for? Mission, environment, task. Where have you shined in your life? What does that tell you when you shine about what you love and what you might have a passion for? And for many people on this call, you don't know the answer to this yet, but you need to find out. Because the trick to being highly successful, it's not a short-term thing. Success is usually back-end loaded. It comes from year after year after year of being in a job and an industry that fits your skills and fits your passions, because you're going to run out of gas if you don't have a passion for it, and it's got to fit your skills. So the trick is, you got to know the world, but I'd say the harder thing for each of you is going to be know yourself. Can you understand yourself? As opposed to follow the crowd who's going left or right, and I've seen lots of people follow what's hot, shy away from what they love because they thought it wasn't cool enough. And it may turn out the thing you love that fits your skills, your friends may think is weird, but they may not think you're weird 20 years from now when you've stayed with it and love what you do. And that's the trick, is not to be a success. The trick is to reach your potential. And the answer to what your potential is different for each and every one of you. So don't follow the crowd. Don't succumb to peer pressure or what's cool. Figure out your strengths and weaknesses and what you have a passion for, and try to find things that fit that. That's my best advice.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram @harvard_ventures. Tune in next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.